Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and catch the live stream from that location also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt, and the live stream is playing there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button for me, please. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is there. Always full of the latest podcast on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or share with your friends. And also check out the Time for Awakening marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting content being posted on there all of the time. African language classes, classes on economics, social systems, health, and many, many more taught by professors on both the continent and the diaspora. So check out the Time for Awakening marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. Make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening media. Tonight, special guests will be joining us to give us an inside look at former President Mugabe, who just was funeralized this weekend in Zimbabwe. And we'll be talking about him and related topics with journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, that's Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Igbona Jr., will be joining us. And we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. You know, our educational tour this afternoon, well, this morning, with Dr. Rashidi was like really inspiring for our discussion tonight with Comrade Brother Mugabe, with Brother Oba. So it's interesting for me. It's always trying to connect our ancient military statesmen lessons of understanding of the times we're in as far as what we need to do to try to make connections between then and now And I think that, you know, going on that tour this morning really helps in our discussion this afternoon. So I'm doing great to be a part of this now.
You know, and it's kind of ironic that we're talking, we're going to do some reflections on President Mugabe tonight with Brother Obi Egbona Jr., who's a journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper, because it was something that Brother Noko said. He said it last week on the program, and he said it today when he talked about the history of our people, and he said he really detests when our people try to start their history, our history, from enslavement. Mm-hmm. And he said he doesn't like to talk about it in relation to that because we are an ancient people and we were here before any of these other folks. But he said if he talks about enslavement, he likes to talk about our people's legacy of resistance to enslavement.
Mm.
And no matter what you might feel in reference to President Mugabe or some of the propaganda that you might hear or see, his legacy of resistance to colonialism and neocolonialism is clear, should be clear to our people. And if it's not, let's get a little insight from our guest tonight, journalist and playwright and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. Brother Obi Egbona Jr. is with us. Brother Obi.
Yes, good evening.
How are you, sir?
Oh, just honored and humbled to be a guest on Time for Awakening, as always.
Well, you don't have to be honest. It's like the living room. We sitting down and your feet's under the table, and we just talking, man.
Yes.
Brother Obi.
How you doing there, brother?
Fine. How you doing, brother?
Good, good, good.
Brother Obi, let's talk about President Mugabe from a person that not only a journalist that writes for The uh-huh. Herald, but you are there. You were with him. You mm-hmm. came in contact with him. And not only that,
yes.
your uh-huh. father, the legacy of you touching. And when I say touching, I'm talking about in conversation directly
right.
In the presence of some of these people that we consider icons is mm-hmm. is something valuable as far as I'm concerned. Because you have an insight and perspective that a lot of us don't get to really understand. Some of these people that you have come in contact with, we read about and we can mm-hmm. kind of surmise their mindsets.
Yeah.
But you have talked with some of these people and you've talked with President Mugabe. Talk about your relationship,
sure.
what you have seen from the government,
yes.
his legacy okay. of resistance. Go ahead.
Okay. That's a lot to tackle, but I'm sincerely going to try my best. Once again, thank you for the opportunity. My condolences to you all, and my condolences to all who embraced Comrade Robert Gabriel Mugabe and understand his role in history, appreciate his role in history, and won't allow anyone that represents our enemies and detractors or are apologists for our enemies and detractors to downplay his role in our struggle or feel that they have the last word on his role in our struggle. I will like to begin, though, by dealing with or focusing on what you said Dr. Rashidi talked about in terms of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this much, though. When you do focus on the resistance, there are two approaches to it. You have analysis by observation and you have analysis by participation. They are not the same. And because our ultimate struggle is to harmonize our theory and practice, as Osagie for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah taught us, practice without thought is blind, thought without action is empty. Even when people focus on the resistance, it's of paramount importance to know that they are part of the process of resistance. Because if they respect it from a distance, it's not the same thing. And this is why we're attempting to urge passionately and humbly and patiently our fellow comrades in the journalist field, when they talk to people about our struggle, if they talk to them about Zimbabwe, if they talk to them about Cuba, if they talk to them about police terrorism, if they talk to them about any issue, that is a frontline issue. They must get from those individuals what their track record is of doing work around that. And we feel that that will crystallize a lot of things. You'll get a more stimulated dialogue going, and you will let people know that this is not a study, but a way of life. Okay. But it's a way of life that must be studied. It's a way of life that must be contextualized. It's a way of life that must be understood. With that being said, what I'll use as a backdrop tonight is 2003, the month of September. Our first work with ZANU-PF, our first work with the government of Zimbabwe, was the last weekend of March in 2002. And that was when their presidential election had just ended. And at the time, the Congressional Black Caucus had refused an invitation from former President Mugabe to come to Zimbabwe and observe the elections. Now, keep in mind that this is 1 year after the Bush administration and the Blair administration imposed the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, the sanctions on Zimbabwe, and not one Black Caucus member voted against those sanctions. The only five that didn't vote in favor of them abstained. The overwhelming 90% of them voted in favor of those sanctions. But he still was willing to overlook that because he felt that they were functioning from a reactionary impulse, an opportunist impulse. And he wanted to give them the opportunity to redeem themselves. And if you know the Black Caucus like I do, the two things they don't turn down are photo ops and trips. But they turned that one down. And the NAACP went in their place. And when the NAACP returned to the United States, they were summoned to the State Department. And for whatever reason, whatever transpired in that meeting they had, they decided not to publish the report on the elections that they wrote, which was a very favorable report. And a year and a half later, we were able to convince our friends high up in the NAACP to at least give ZANU-PF their copy so they could use it. But between March of 2002 and the fall of 2003, I was in an organization at the time called the Pan-African Liberation Organization, now defunct, which had blossomed from the Pan-African Student Youth Movement, which was created way back in 1990. And so what happened is we helped organize the Zimbabwean ambassador at the time to the United States, Dr. Simbi Mubako. We organized activities for him in Philadelphia, in Selma, Alabama, in Columbia, South Carolina, in Richmond, Virginia, in Petersburg, Virginia, in Norfolk, Virginia, in St. Louis, Missouri, in Atlanta, Georgia, in California, in Texas, in New Jersey. And the objective was to build a support system for the Zimbabwean government that was even more deliberate and unapologetic and militant as the support they enjoyed when they were embarking on the 14-year protracted armed struggle that liberated Zimbabwe from the clutches of British and Rhodesian colonialism. So on a Friday evening in 2003, I believe it was the third week of September, I receive a phone call from Ambassador Mubako's secretary. And she says that I'm to call him at once. And it's like 11:30 at night. It is extremely urgent. And so she tells me that, so she gives me the number I could reach him on. So I call him. And he said, did you know that you had an article that came out in the Herald? I said, no. And it had been originally written, and thanks to Lorenzo Martin, the publisher of the Chicago Standard newspapers. And that was the first time we were ever published in the Herald. The article was entitled, Who Else But Mugabe? And so what happened was he asked me, was I off? He knew I was off on Mondays. At the time, I was running a dormitory at Bowie State University. And I said, yes, I'm off on Monday. I said, you're home? You just got back from home? He said, yeah, I'm at the United Nations for the General Assembly. And he said, you're too revolutionary to pay attention to that stuff. I said, no particular reason, just it's not on the radar. And he said, well, you need to get up to New York by noon on Monday. And I said, what's going on? He said, President Mugabe would like to meet you. And I said, what? He said, yeah, he would like to meet you. And I thought initially the reason was because about a few weeks before that, at the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington, we waited 6 hours on stage for 3 minutes. And in the 3 minutes that we were afforded, we used the platform to call for the lifting of the sanctions on Zimbabwe and to call for the lifting of the blockade on Cuba. And so we thought that it may have a lot to do with that. But when we got there, we found out that he just found it interesting because the organization in Zimbabwe that is recognized as the main group that drives Zimbabwean solidarity in our community is a group based out of New York called the December 12th Movement. Mm-hmm. And they are very consistent and they are very committed to Zimbabwe. So former President Mugabe, Comrade R.G. Mugabe, was trying to figure out how in a year and a half, how they were moving around so rapidly, the diplomatic corps. And he was trying to figure out who were some people who were in their early 30s that were making this happen. And he'd never heard of us before. So my comrade and I, Devin Walker, went up and we had a 1 hour meeting, an hour and a half meeting with him, a private meeting. And I can tell you, when the meeting began, I was sitting there in the back of my head. I said, so this is what Kwame Ture was talking about when he said that he had lunch with Ho Chi Minh, when SNCC went to Hanoi to meet Ho Chi Minh, to declare their support for him, not only just come out against the Vietnam War, but to come out in favor of Ho Chi Minh. So the meeting began, he just started, and he said that his criticism of so-called African-Americans when it comes to looking at developments on the African continent is we have a very sensationalized, adventurous, and romantic perception of those developments. And what he was speaking about in particular, he said, we focus so much on assassinations and coups, but we pay very little attention to the methodology used by imperialism to isolate a nation, to make them vulnerable to a coup, vulnerable to an assassination, vulnerable to an invasion. And interestingly enough, this is 2003 that we're having this. And then, of course, you know, he thanked us. And recently on Facebook, for the first time, we took a photograph with him. I'd never made that photograph public, but I made that photograph public. But I made that public for the younger organizers in our community, the ones who were just getting their feet wet and struggle. Because when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you're 23 years old, you're 24 years old, you've only really had 2 years in struggle, 1 year in struggle, 3 years in struggle, 4 years in struggle. Imagine if you were a human being at 4 years old, 3 years old. So that's what you kind of have to think about. So a lot of the things we do is we're approaching 50 biologically in 3 weeks, but politically we're 30 years old. We're about to be 30. Now, I say that to say that when people see that photograph, we explained the work we did to get in the room. Because the two of you know that people do this a lot. It's become a very negligent, degrading, irresponsible subculture, cancerous subculture, if you will, in our movement, where people will go to Zimbabwe, go to Cuba, go to Bolivia, go to Venezuela. And the motivation for going is to have a photo op with Comrade R.G. Mugabe, have a photo op with Comandante Fidel Castro, have a photo op with this one and that one. Prior to doing any work to solidify a bond with the struggle that they represent, with the struggle that best defines who they are. So we felt it was important to let people know that that picture represented a year and a half of constant daily work. And after the meeting, the work intensified. So he then went on to say that imperialism underestimated the fraternal and maternal bond between the SADC people, the Southern African Development Community. For your listeners who don't know what that is, that's the umbrella that all the Southern African nations belong to. And he said that they anticipated with Mandela retiring, with Njoma on the way out of office, with Chissano in Mozambique on the way out of office, and him and Dos Santos of Angola being the only members of when they were the frontline state still left, they thought the newer leadership coming into play were moderate in comparison to Samora Machel, in comparison to Tsiritsi Kama, in comparison to Kenneth Kaunda. He said, but what they're going to find out is that that bond is stronger than ever, and Zimbabwe played a role in intensifying that process. And he said, and in the same vein that Zimbabwe has intensified that process in Southern Africa, where even before the land reclamation program, the year before that, spearheading Operation Sovereign Legitimacy, where President Mugabe, it was Zimbabwe's turn to chair the SADC Defense Forces. Every year, that's a rotational seat, where a president of a SADC nation oversees the military affairs of all 14 nations that make up SADC. And a decision was made that Zimbabwe's fighting forces, Namibia's fighting forces, and Angola's fighting forces would defend the territorial integrity of the Democratic Republic of Congo, who was new to the SADC family. And at the time, Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, and the spokesperson for African Affairs during Clinton's administration, Susan Rice, who is the same Susan Rice who was Obama's national security advisor, had planned to reinvade the Congo to reestablish Mobutu's network after Mobutu had passed on and had been ousted from power even before he passed on. So he shared a lot of that with us, and we didn't even want to talk, but he said that this is a working meeting. This is an exchange between comrades. So he wanted to know a little bit about us. So we talked about our work with PAC. We talked about our work with ANC. We talked about our work with ASAPO and how we felt defending the territorial integrity of Zimbabwe was an extension of that work. And we quoted, and then Ambassador Mubako weighed in and told him who my father was. He said, that's another reason I wanted to see you in particular. I love dealing with any Nkrumist. He said, because when our story is written, people will put us in the Marxist camp because of Cold War politics. Because of our close relationship to the Chinese, which we make no apology for, they'll put us in the Maoist camp. But people have to remember that it was when I breathed the free soil while I was teaching at St. Mary's College in Takoradi, where I met my first wife, Sally Mugabe. That's when my revolutionary spirit was born. And then when you remember that Nkrumah said that Ghana's independence is meaningless unless it's linked to the independence of the entire African continent. And then for Sally Mugabe, following another dictum by the Osagyefo, the best way to measure the degree of a country's revolutionary awareness is by the political maturity of its women. And so 2003-2002 was a very important time because you were 2 years removed from the launching of the land reclamation program. You were 3 years removed from the Lancaster House negotiations. A couple of years later, President Mugabe, and just being with him at the UN on a multiple of occasions, just watching how he maneuvered and watching how he used that platform, because for those of us in this country, when we think of the UN, we think of the League of Nations and how the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey submitted an appeal to the League of Nations. We then think of 1947 when Du Bois submits an appeal, and Eleanor Roosevelt was on the board of directors of the NAACP at the time, and she tried to stop Du Bois' appeal from being submitted. And then we think that that's what Brother Malcolm was trying to do. So we know how we've always used the platform of the UN, but to see a head of state use it the way that he used it, to see how the brand of nationalism that Zimbabwe was, that defined the Chimurenga, which is what revolution means in Shona, you look at it from the context that they were too nationalist for the Soviet Union even. The Soviet Union had a handful of liberation movements in Africa that they called authentic. The African National Congress won. Frelimo in Mozambique won. SWAPO in Namibia won. MPLA in Angola won. Cabral in the PAIGC won. A movement in the Comoros Islands, the other one. But they felt that ZANU was a little over the top with nationalism. And at a moment in history where many people now are associating nationalism with Trump, the same way they associate nationalism with Mussolini or associate nationalism with Hitler even, Africans have done more to purify nationalism as a concept as we have to purify Christianity and purify Islam and purify Judaism. Every monotheistic spiritual belief that we've given substance and dimension to, don't downplay what Africans have done to nationalism. So these are some of the things that Comrade R.G. Mugabe defined. He was born in a fantastic era. He's born in 1924. Between 1924 and 1925, you know who came to us through the womb? Around that time, Mangalizo Robert Sobukwe, the founder of the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, comes to us through the womb. Malcolm comes through the womb. Fanon comes through the womb. Lumumba comes through the womb. Comrade R.G. Mugabe comes through the womb. He comes through the womb 9 years after 1915. I bring that up because for those of you who may not know, Comrade R.G. Mugabe's dad was Malawian. So President Mugabe is part Malawian and part Zimbabwean. And if you know Malawian history, in 1915, a reverend named John Chilimbwe, after coming from Virginia Theological Seminary, goes back to Malawi and organizes an armed revolt, just like Nat Turner's, just like Denmark Vesey's, just like what Gabriel Prosser planned to do, in the name of Jesus. And that's very important because if you know Comrade R.G. Mugabe's history, those of us who are products of the student movement, we salute him as well because of the fact that, when you look at the history of Fort Hare University in what's called South Africa, Comrade R.G. Mugabe is there at the same time Madiba Nelson Mandela is there. Herbert Chitepo, the first leader of ZANU, Nyerere was there. Sobukwe was there. And at the time, all those revolutionary freedom fighters, they had their face buried in Gandhi's writing. So just like Joe Lowry, just like Martin Luther King, just like Andrew Young, just like Ralph Abernathy, just like James Farmer, just like the NAACP, because if you were in the civil rights movement in this country in the 40s, the 50s, and 60s, it was a prerequisite that you studied Gandhi like Muslims study the Quran and Christians study the Bible. However, for whatever reason, those Africans in Southern Africa, even though they knew their Gandhi, could quote Gandhi upside down, sideways, from a 180-degree angle. When it came time to pick up the gun, they didn't say, this is inconsistent with Gandhi's principles. They did what was necessary on a tactical level, because as we know, Malcolm was correct. By any means necessary, use whatever tactic has the best results. So going back to the interaction with Comrade R.G. Mugabe, he felt that based on what we had done in a little bit of time, what he wanted to see us do as the next step is to go on the ground at home and do some different things. But we told him the reason we weren't ready, we wanted to continue to build on our work in the United States. Then when we went home, we wouldn't be strangers. They would know us through our work. And the reason we felt that way, because another opportunist, degrading subculture, deals with travel. And you have people who go home on our behalf, and they represent what we call splash delegations. Think of your baby splashing in the bathtub, or a child splashing at the baby pool, at the public pools. And they go there, they expect to be treated like a head of state, they get red carpet treatment, and they come back to the United States and they bang on podiums and they poke their chest out about the trips they took. But a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, 4 months later, you forgot they went, and they definitely don't follow up, and they don't honor whatever promises they made. So what ends up happening is they're exploiting the mileage of that issue. They're making a whore out of that issue, excuse my language. So we felt we're going to approach going to Zimbabwe the way France Fanon approached going to Algeria, the way W.E.B. Du Bois and Shirley Graham Du Bois approached going to Ghana, the way Robert and Sarah Lee approached going to Ghana, the way Julian Mayfield and Maya Angelou and Tom Feelings approached going to Ghana, the way Kwame Ture approached going to Guinea, the way Asada Shakur and Nahanda Obiodun approached going to Cuba, in the spirit of struggle. And that is why when we went there, the first time, we ended up, of course, accepting the assignment to write for the Herald. But not only that, we were recruited into the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association by the highest-ranking Cuban diplomat ever to be deported from the United States under false charges of espionage, Cosme Torres Espinoza, whose next assignment was to be the Zimbabwean ambassador to Cuba. And understand it from the perspective that Comrade R.G. Mugabe is the only African head of state in history to receive both the Jose Marti Award, Cuba's highest honor, and the Simon Bolivar Award, Venezuela's highest honor. And I say that because Kwame Ture also taught us between 1990 and 1998 that when you're on the path of revolution, you seek the most difficult tasks. I could tell you, Cuba's easy. Venezuela's easy. Palestine is easy. Zimbabwe is different. Cuba would be multiplication. Venezuela would be division. Palestine would be addition and subtraction. Zimbabwe is calculus three. I'm telling you. So, but that is what attracts us to it, because if you're a fighter, if you strive to be a fighter, you're attracted to challenges, you're attracted to your historical responsibility. You're not attracted to recognition. You're not attracted to awards. You're not attracted to accolades. That way we ensure that you're not walking around with a parachute on your shoulders. You're humble at all times. We were touched by Comrade Mugabe's humility, but that was the thing that made him stand out in the Zimbabwean struggle. If you know the history of that struggle, he wasn't even the original leader of ZANU. It was a Reverend Chitole. And when they all went to prison in the mid-60s for their role in initiating an armed struggle, Chitole was meeting behind the back of the Central Committee of ZANU with the Rhodesians, saying that he would suspend the armed struggle in exchange for not being put to death. When they found that out, and another great man, who they call the Lion of Zimbabwe, Leopold Takawira, he was next in command. But what they attempted to do to Mumia Abu-Jamal, they successfully did to Comrade Takawira. He was a diabetic, and they knew he was a diabetic, so they deprived him of his medicine. So he died of a diabetic stroke while in the custody of the Rhodesians. So it was Comrade Mugabe's turn to take the helm of ZANU. And in the beginning, Kaunda was in Zambia, Samora Machel was in Mozambique, Nyerere was in Tanzania. So they were involved in some negotiating. And they didn't know who Comrade Mugabe was. No one knew him outside of Zimbabwe, with the exception of Ghana. And so when he showed up for the negotiations, they sent him back and said, bring Chitole. And even though Chitole had turned his back on ZANU, he still was privy to the dialogue. When Comrade Mugabe, R.G. Mugabe, first showed up in Mozambique after escaping from Harare to Mozambique when he had a contract on his life, and he successfully escaped from Harare to Maputo, where Frelimo had set up a guerrilla station for the ZANU guerrillas, he was put into custody because they didn't believe he was who he was. And they said, this Mugabe guy again. And the guerrillas in the camps had to say, that is our leader. He is here to engineer the final phase of our armed struggle. On the educational front, Mugabe's a teacher, just like Nyerere's a teacher, just like Sobukwe is a teacher, just like Du Bois is a teacher, just like John Henry Clark is a teacher, just like Marva Collins is a teacher, just like many of the pioneers that we have whose training was in the Septima Clark being a teacher. Matter of fact, I believe she was fired after teaching in South Carolina for 40 years because it was against the law to join the NAACP at the time. So he represents that legacy as well. And so there are just so many layers to this man, Comrade R.G. Mugabe. And of course, he made the 90s club. He leaves us at 95 years old. Du Bois was 95. When he transitioned in Ghana 24 hours before the March on Washington. Chancellor Williams is part of that 90s club. Dr. Ben Yochanan is part of that 90s club. Catherine Dunham left us in her 90s. The legacy is not just rich, it's robust. And it's just one of those situations where we understand why people may not know certain things, because as we know, we have restricted the history of Southern Africa, 14 nations, to the history of South Africa, and dare I say, the autobiographies of Madiba, Nelson Mandela, and Winnie Mandela. I've been getting that question all week long, compare him to Mandela. Let me just say this much, that's not fair to Mandela. Mandela did not engineer an armed struggle. Mandela did not reclaim his people's land. That is no criticism of him. That's no indictment of him. That's just scientific, irrefutable fact.
Okay.
But I will say this, and Mandela was not committed to the United Front like Comrade R.G. Mugabe. If you know the history of Zimbabwe, you know that ZANU, the Zimbabwe African National Union, comes from Zimbabwe African People's Union, the first liberation movement established. The father of that struggle is none other than Joshua Nkomo, who they still call in Zimbabwe Father Zimbabwe. They consider Nkomo father of the struggle. They consider Comrade R.G. Mugabe father of the nation. Now, Comrade R.G. Mugabe was Joshua Nkomo's press secretary, but he felt that ZAPU was soft on armed struggle, was soft on nationalism, was soft on Pan-Africanism, was soft on socialism. They were confused. So he felt a more militant directive need to be pushed by another organization. And the beautiful thing about it, when Nkomo found out that some key people had left ZAPU to start ZANU, and he asked who left, and he said, "Robert left me?" And they said, "Yeah." He said, "I lost a man of principle." So he knew the quality. He knew the context. He knew the commitment. He knew the discipline. So Comrade R.G. Mugabe, and the thing about it was, as soon as he went back to Zimbabwe, his son, the only child him and Amai Sally had, died of malaria, and they didn't allow him to go to the funeral. But getting back to the Mandela thing, Mandela attacked Comrade R.G. Mugabe at least three times. The first time, he was almost belligerent that Comrade R.G. Mugabe felt that a military response was necessary to defend the Congo. So he screamed at Comrade R.G. Mugabe. He screamed at Dos Santos. He screamed at Njoma, but he was outvoted. And then he went public. He was angry at Comrade R.G. Mugabe because, if you know anything about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they were pardoning all the Boers, the Dutch and the Afrikaners, for their atrocities during apartheid. But there was a point where the ANC support center in Harare, some terrorists, some apartheid regime terrorists, tried to blow it up, and they were incarcerated in Harare. So Desmond Tutu had asked Comrade R.G. Mugabe to release them. He said, "You know better than that." So he had Mandela call, and he explained to Mandela why he couldn't do it. So Mandela was upset about that. But the most visible criticism was in 2008, when cutting his birthday cake, sitting next to Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, he said there's a tragic absence of leadership in Zimbabwe. Now, what's interesting about that is that South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they got the Madiba a Nobel Peace Prize, they got Desmond Tutu a Nobel Peace Prize, they got the idea from Comrade R.G. Mugabe when he pardoned Ian Smith and the Rhodesians in 1980, when the whole world was begging for him to put them on a firing squad. He refused. He said, "We must move beyond this." And in terms of, and then the last thing, at the end of 2008, Mandela, Kofi Annan, Gracia Marshall Mandela, Jimmy Carter, created a group called the Elders Group, where these were distinguished people who had distinguished portfolios who would lend their voice to world issues. They attempted to force their way into Zimbabwe under the guise of human rights violations. And the interesting thing about that is the money to start the Elders Group, $36 million was put up. Peter Gabriel, the rock singer, did some concerts that raised $18 million. But the initial $18 million was put up by none other than Sir Richard Branson, the CEO of Virgin Airlines. And if you know anything about Virgin Airlines, Virgin Airlines has been supporting the opposition in Zimbabwe because an arrangement was made between the opposition to Comrade R.G. Mugabe, MDC, that if MDC ever came to power, they would relinquish control of the tourism industry in Zimbabwe to Virgin Airlines. In the same vein that R.J. Reynolds and the Philip Morris Company have been working with MDC to overthrow ZANU-PF, because if MDC comes to power, they would relinquish control of the tobacco industry to R.J. Reynolds and the Philip Morris Company. So these are the things that Comrade R.G. Mugabe was up against in the 37 years he was in power, but he held firm. And just the fact he never even responded to Mandela's criticism, never responded to it, never even dignified it, because and the interesting thing is, I was in Zimbabwe once, and one of Mandela's grandchildren were on TV, and they said, "Who's your favorite African leader besides your grandfather?" He said, "You need to ask Comrade R.G. Mugabe all day long." And this is the everyday Africans. That's where he found his love. That's where he was encouraged. So this is why when the Congressional Black Caucus was working for his demise, he was impervious to their criticism. I remember being with him in the UN in 2013, and he looked right in Barbara Lee's face, and he said to those of you who are obsessed with Zimbabwe's affairs and cannot stop meddling, three words for you: shame, shame, shame. And she walked out the room. And she was there because the United States government, let's just deal with the UN real quickly. Some of the things that have happened at the UN during the time of Comrade R.G. Mugabe that have been part of the regime change agenda. I mentioned in 2005, he went to Rome, not because he wanted to go to the Vatican, but because he was there for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization meeting. And the U.S. ambassador to the process, Tony Hall, tried to use United States imperialist muscle to prevent him from addressing the body. When he found that out, he got up there and he called Bush and Blair the two biggest terrorists on the planet. And if you go back to the Washington Times the weekend after the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is in a small caption, Comrade R.G. Mugabe's on the front of the paper. In 2007, the United States and European Union tried to prevent Zimbabwe from chairing the UN Committee on Sustainable Development. It was rejected outright. In 2008, the United States and European Union tried to get the United Nations Security Council to impose additional sanctions on Zimbabwe. It was vetoed by the Chinese and the Russians. So they had some very significant victories at the United Nations level. Another personal example of his calmness and his humility, I was with him in his suite when Congressman Gregory Meeks, who at the time had replaced Donald Payne on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy. I'll get to that in a second. And Danny Davis out of Chicago. In typical Black Caucus behavior, now they're coming to meet with the head of state. They're late. They're half an hour late. And interestingly enough, they had just come from Zimbabwe. And when they were in Zimbabwe, this was during the inclusive government, when Comrade R.G. Mugabe and ZANU-PF felt that they should share power with the opposition, just to show the world that the opposition had no program, no program for education, no program for health care, no program for agricultural development. Congressman Meeks and Congressman Davis went to Zimbabwe. They didn't even meet with Comrade R.G. Mugabe, but they met with the late Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. And the reason they gave is because they had a plane to catch. So they show up in his suite late, and they talk for an hour. And they say that they're going to reevaluate the policy. He's just sitting there watching them. And it was different to me because I was like, wow, when he met with us 6 years before that, he just started talking. He didn't say a word to them. He's just sitting there watching them very intently. And then after they finished talking for an hour, he asked them one question. Understanding that the two of you and the Black Caucus collectively came 5 votes short of voting in favor of sanctions on Zimbabwe, are you now going to go before the U.S. Congress and acknowledge that you were wrong and say that you want to repeal your votes? The meeting was over after that. There was a whole lot of stuttering, a whole lot of stammering, and it was just incredible that they thought that they could insult his intelligence like that. A man that brilliant, a man that visionary. And the interesting thing about this is, as we're having an intense conversation around reparations, I want John Conyers to explain to our community, how the hell can you have a reparations bill on the floor of the Senate and on the floor of Congress when you voted in favor of sanctions on Zimbabwe for reclaiming our land? And when you put that in the context of the fact that when Jimmy Carter and Margaret Thatcher negotiated the Lancaster House Agreement, where between 1980 and 1990, $5 billion was supposed to be put up to transfer the Europeans that were there, the colonialists, off the land that they occupied. They could either go back to Europe where their ancestors came from, or they could transition to a regular house, a regular apartment, a regular condominium, however it was, but they would no longer occupy farms half the size of West Philly or North Philly. Those days had come and gone. It was a new day. It was a new horizon. We were independent. We were sovereign, right? So Reagan comes in and says he's not honoring the agreement. Did the Black Caucus use their platform to say Reagan must honor Lancaster? Did Reverend Jesse Jackson, which to his credit he admits was an error on his part, and neither in his 84 or 88 campaign, that wasn't part of the Africa policy for him. Think about every nationalist organization you know that was active at the time. How many of them pounded the pavement saying that the white left who say that they're anti-imperialist, don't judge them by their skin color. They sure said lift the blockade on Cuba. They talked about El Salvador. They talked about Nicaragua. They talked about all these other issues. Did they ever mention Zimbabwe? The anti-war white folk now that will march at the drop of a hat for Venezuela, march at the drop of a hat for Cuba. You never heard them say sanctions on Zimbabwe must be lifted, sanctions on Eritrea must be lifted. But after all, Africa in their eyes is the dark side of the moon, no matter how progressive they'd like to think they are. So, I mean, we understand this, and this is the legacy of this. This is the legacy of the giant that we just lost. But he hasn't gone anywhere. His spirit, the same way that in 1896, when they hung Mbuya de Honda, who started the first armed revolt against the British and Rhodesians, and before she was hung, she said, "Mafupa angu achu muka, my bones will rise." And 24 years later, the founding father of Zimbabwe was born. Evidently, her bones rose within him, rose within Josiah Tongogawa, rose within Herbert Chitepo, rose within Nathan Shamirira. In conclusion, I think when we deal with the land issue in Zimbabwe, the indigenization issue in Zimbabwe, one of the things that Dr. Nathan Shamirira, who was Zimbabwe's first foreign minister, who I became very close to, spent a lot of quality time with, and I'm so thankful to Mother Africa for allowing me to have time with him. Once again, Brother Elliot and Richard, these are working relationships. There's no such thing as a political groupie. We don't do that. But anyway, he said, you know, comrade, this land issue is going to intensify the push for socialism in Africa. I want you, your listeners, to hear me very well tonight. As this is considered the year, once again, there are so many beneficiaries that are standing on Zimbabwe's shoulders and don't give credit. The reason that the African Union has an aggressive focus on agriculture and food security is because of the land reclamation program in Zimbabwe. The reason that we've had several women prime ministers in Africa, and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf became the president of Liberia and Joyce Banda became the president of Malawi, was because Comrade R.G. Mugabe put Amai Joyce Mujuru, the highest-ranking woman guerrilla fighter during the second Chimurenga, made her the first woman vice president after one of his best friends, Simon Muzenda, passed away in the early 2000s. And Zimbabwe never took credit for that. The fact that 68% of the women of the farming done in Zimbabwe on our land is being done by women, but Zimbabwe doesn't take credit for it. For those of you, whether you've been fighting to keep the doors of your HBCUs open, defending African independent schools, fighting for affirmative action, you should feel this loss because Zimbabwe has a 97% literacy rate. But you never heard him poke his chest out and give, you know, he gave credit to the Cubans because Comandante Fidel Castro gave the green light for 3,000 Zimbabwean teachers to be trained in Cuba between 1986 and 1996, the first one being the chair of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association that I belong to, Fananinzo Pazinai, Comrade Pazinai. So, but 7 years ago, Zimbabwe and Zambia chaired the United Nations World Tourism Organization Summit. And what that did is it made the whole world recognize the value of African tourism. But whenever you hear people talk about tourism in Africa, you don't hear, and the irony was that a nation that was being vilified, a nation that if you looked on the U.S. State Department's broadcast, they said for U.S. citizens, non-essential travel to Zimbabwe should be deferred, which was a methodological jump from what they tell you about Cuba. When it comes to Cuba, they say, nigga, you know better. You better not go. When it comes to Africa, they say, oh, you shouldn't go. Because they know you can't tell us we can't go to Africa. We'll go just to define. We're bare minimum that nationalists. But now you have this reactionary Akufo Addo in Ghana who's benefiting from the tourist, the influx of the work Zimbabwe is doing. And he actually was there to pay his respects this weekend. I thought that was nice of him. Because if you think about it, the year return agenda that he's pushing, it's in concert with the U.S. Africa Business Center. Everyone that's been going to Ghana that went and didn't know this, shame on you, but we love you. So now you can look this up after you hear this show. And the U.S. Africa Business Center is the Africa component of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the main partner that President Akufo Addo has is a woman named Rosa Whitaker. For those of you who don't know who Rosa Whitaker is, she wrote, she's called the mother of AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. She's the first trade officer, Africa trade officer in U.S. governmental history, appointed by many of your favorite white liberal, Bill Clinton. And this is the same time that the Corporate Council on Africa was created. So when you look at that in the context of the Council of Foreign Relations relationship to the African continent, when you look at that in relationship to the fact that Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton are co-sponsors of the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, when you look at the fact that Donald Payne, who was the Africa expert within the CBC, was the one who walked the sanctions on Zimbabwe through Congress with his Republican counterpart in New Jersey, Christopher Smith, you think about that. And the fact that what we're doing is we're Pan-Africanizing neocolonialism. And I say that because Comrade Arjie Mugabe represents the defeat of civilian neocolonialism. Because in the 1990s, when we shut this country down over the Rodney King verdict, when we took the street, when we shut D.C. down, we let it be known. This isn't about Rodney King. This is about imperialism policing the world, policing the African world. So as you police us in D.C., you police us in New York, you police us in Missouri, you also police us in Zimbabwe. You police us in Ghana. You police us in Burkina Faso. You police us in the Congo. You police us in Colombia, South America. You police us everywhere. So this is why what Comrade Arjie Mugabe did. And now when you look at it in relationship to the white woman who became the ambassador to Botswana that came to from Chicago with Barack to D.C. named Michelle Gavin, who started off as a fellow in the Council of Foreign Relations. And her paper was called Planning for Post-Mugabe Zimbabwe. She ends up on the National Security Council's Africa desk, and she ends up the ambassador to Botswana. And interestingly enough, Ian Khama, the son of the father of Botswana, Seretse Khama, he said, if you all decide to invade Zimbabwe, you can use Botswana's space. But of course, SADC shut him down. The same way that SADC shut down Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, where she forgot she was the president of Liberia and evidently had a flashback to her days when she was part of the John F. Kennedy School of Strategic Government at Harvard University. Or Comprere, the pig who assassinated our beautiful brother Thomas Sankara when he had something to say about Zimbabwe. As a matter of fact, and then Southern Africa spoke strong in 2007 when British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, they had an EU-Africa summit in Portugal, and he said, if Mugabe comes, I'm not coming. All of Southern Africa sent him a communique. Look here, white man, if Mugabe don't come, Comrade Arjie Mugabe, ain't none of us coming. You can't have no Africa summit if the most politically stable region of Africa is absent. Get over yourself, white man. And so this was the type of energy that Comrade Arjie Mugabe resurrected within us. And for those who had the opportunity, who met with him, promised him certain things, didn't deliver on those things, we're not going to put you on blast. We're not going to expose that, at least not today. But what we will say about that is, if you really feel his debt, you now come forward and push for the sanctions to be lifted on Zimbabwe. If those of you in Malefi Asante, my brother, who's a very ardent supporter of Comrade Arjie Mugabe, he's at Temple University. Temple University should have a conference next year on U.S.-Africa policy, especially since it's a presidential year. And we can ask Mark Lamont Hill. If Mark Lamont Hill is listening, we got a message for you. Nothing antagonistic. You know, let me just say this.
You're putting it right.
We appreciate everything you've done for the Palestinians. But let me tell you, and I'm your big brother. I'll be 50 years old. But this is the thing. Tom Lantos, the Zionist in Congress, the same one that went before Congress and repudiated Khalid Muhammad, he was the one who was very aggressive in pushing the Congressional Black Caucus to vote in favor of the sanctions on Zimbabwe. For those of you who live your life watching the lover's quarrel between Democrats and Republicans, FYI for you, Bernie Sanders, as a congressman of Vermont, voted in favor of those sanctions. So when he comes out against reparations, he's consistent on Africans not being empowered. He doesn't want you to have reparations if you were born in the United States, and he doesn't want Zimbabweans to reclaim their land from Rhodesians and British. So he's a consistent, deceitful, white liberal pig. But getting back to this whole thing about the fact that the Zionists hated Comrade R.G. Mugabe because of the relationship between the Zimbabweans and the Palestinians. At a time where formerly the OAU, now the African Union, we had what was called the OAU Liberation Committee. And every year, every time that Liberation Committee had a meeting to get an update on the liberation struggles in Zimbabwe, the liberation struggles in Mozambique, the liberation struggles in Namibia, Yasser Arafat, representing the PLO, would come personally to pledge his support for those liberation struggles. And so when we talk about Zionism being a direct enemy of our people, it isn't just about the slaughtering of the Palestinian people. It's their role in undermining the Algerian revolution, their role in undermining the Tunisian revolution, their role in undermining, helping push the sanctions on Zimbabwe, their role in supporting Portuguese colonialism in Mozambique and Angola. So part of this conference that could take place at Temple, I would be willing to do a special session with you that children from all over Philadelphia should come to, where we talk about the parallels between Zimbabwe and Palestine. Whenever you want to do that, Brother Mark, we're ready. And our brother Omawali, through Afrocentric International, had been trying to set that up. So we're going to be talking with our brother Malefi Asante within the next couple of days. We just got his cell phone number. We had lost it. We just got it today. You will be getting a call from us. You better bet that. So that's the only thing that I had to say about that. And just in closing,
don't close yet. Huh? We're going to take a brief break. Don't close yet. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, I got a couple things I want you to hear because I want your opinion on it as a journalist. And as a man that has seen a lot of these movements from the grassroots level on the continent.
I hope I did what you expected. I hope I didn't take too long.
Well, wait a minute. I'm going to take a brief break. But before we go, Richard, you got a couple questions. And keep it short, brother Obi. I'm going to take a break. But go ahead.
I'll be short with the questions.
Go ahead, Richard.
No, I don't. I'm good.
Well, good. We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, I want to play a clip or two for you, Brother O, because I want your opinion. I know your opinion on the people, the person that's saying it, but I want your opinion on what he is saying this clip. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can get involved in the conversation as always. Brother O will let you in by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation this evening with journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, that's Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Egbona Jr., just doing some reflections on the revolutionary legacy of President Robert Mugabe. We'll be right back. If I can get this commercial queued up, we'll be right back.
Excuse me. I was just coming behind you. I didn't want to start it. Have a good night.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP of the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I say that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back. The time for an awakening is 8:23 in the city of Philadelphia, and we're joined in conversation tonight by journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald. That's Zimbabwe's national newspaper. Brother Obi Igbona Jr. is with us this evening discussing reflections on the revolutionary legacy of President Robert Mugabe. Before we, Brother Obi, you still with us? Before I play that clip for you, I want to, because there's a couple callers on hold here, I want to go to them. We did have a question in the chat room. Let me see here. What does it say here? If I can pull it up. It says, can you ask the guests about Cheryl Mills Black Ivy opening Africa for Business? She was a HRC right-hand girl. Do you know what he's referring to, Brother? I'm not familiar with her.
I don't have any idea. But my thing is, you know, the business of liberation is the only business that I'm interested in, and defending the sovereignty of those of the nations and liberation movements and comrades who best embody that in their work and service to us. That's the only thing we're willing to deal with. And Achmed Sekou-Touré dealt with that a long time ago. He said it is not the adaptation of political action to economic action. On the contrary, it's the use of economic activities for political ends. So with that being said, if people want to invest in Africa, let's invest in the Cuban doctors' efforts on the African continent. They said that if the resources were ever available, they would deploy 4,000 doctors, researchers, nurses, and specialists to the African continent, and they would remain until the HIV/AIDS pandemic is eradicated. And then when you think about the 4,000 doctors they have there performing a multitude of services, on behalf of the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, we have been pushing a project called Cuba, a More Africa, Africa, a More Cuba. And that's something that we can go through the African Union and do, so we don't have to worry about persecution from U.S. imperialism if we decide to step up to the plate to get that done. Okay. So that's something that we can look at doing if people are interested. So that's all I got to say about it.
Well, let me take a couple of these calls here, get them involved. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News?
Oh, yes. Hello, brother. I thought maybe you would know who Cheryl Mills was because she was Hillary Clinton's right-hand girl. And then when Hillary dropped down from the State Department, she actually opened business supposedly as a front to a gateway to Africa. So I just thought maybe you understood. You might have known who she was.
No. Our focus was more at that time during that period. We were focusing more on the African Growth and Opportunity Act because an African woman, Rosa Whitaker, put that in place, and the role of the Corporate Council in Africa in the process. And in the last few years, so that was more our focus. And like I said, once again, from the standpoint of regime change, how that's used as an instrument. And like I said, what we're witnessing is people comfortable with a neo-colonialist paradigm, unfortunately. So that's kind of where we are with that. But thank you for sharing that. Really appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you, bro.
Thank you.
Let's go to caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from? Caller, are you there? Let's put him back on hold. He might have stepped away. Let's go to Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge. Caller, are you there?
Yes. Mr. Egbuna, I'm really impressed and appreciative of your encyclopedic review and update of the struggle in Southern Africa. But I have two questions. It's really one question. You had suggested that Africans have essentially transformed European ideas, like the ideal of nationalism and so on. And I was wondering if you could expand on that. And also, you give the critique of neocolonialism, but what's the vision? What would the world look like if the world were right by you?
Africa would be liberated, unified, and socialist. Every African would enjoy the wealth of Africa. Everyone in Mali would be like Modibo Keita was, not like Mansa Musa, where what he had, $400 billion to himself. And when he felt like it, he shared some of the gold with us like it was his to share in the first place. So we would be nothing like some of the dynasties that are celebrated where they monopolize the wealth, because capitalism finds its ancestral roots in feudalism and socialism finds its ancestral roots in communalism. So that's answering the first question, the first part of that question. But what I expanded on, no. What I was saying was that those who captured our ancestors, those who raped and plundered our continent, they don't have the monopoly on nationalism. So when we think of nationalism, because you're hearing people now say, white supremacist and nationalism, forgetting Malcolm, forgetting the messenger, forgetting the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, forgetting Blyden, forgetting Padmore, forgetting Booker T. Washington, forgetting our rich history with nationalism, we have given character and dimension and substance and integrity to nationalism and in its highest expression, Pan-Africanism. There are some who say they're Pan-Africanist nationalists, but we say whatever that is, because that's like a woman putting on a blouse before a bra. But, you know, people's interpretations are based on their study, I guess. Next. What's next, Elliot?
And finally, if I can get one more lick in,
go ahead.
Do you have any comments about Cedric Richardson?
I know. Who is Cedric?
Excuse me, I'm confusing the names here. Cedric Richmond.
Cedric Richmond. Who's Cedric Richmond?
The political philosopher. But in any case, well, you were talking about the origins of capitalism and socialism and so on, and I was thinking maybe that you were familiar with his work. But okay. But man, this is brilliant, man. This is I'm enjoying every bit.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Who we got next?
Let me go back. Maybe the caller came back to his phone. Let's go to caller, are you there? What's your name? Where are you calling from? Caller? Maybe they're still away. Brother Obi, let me play this clip for you because I want your opinion on what he states. Now, we see here, we get clips on different news sources the African Union coming together to form one economy for the 54 countries. We see movements towards progress for the continent, irregardless of some of the leaders, which are capitalists. I'm looking at the underlying vision of the people. Now, you look at South Africa and you see what's going on there. You also see earlier this year that they pulled their ambassador to Israel, not only because of their treatment of Palestinians, but their interference in Southern African affairs. And now you see things going on now with the attacks on other Africans. I want to play this clip for you. And like I said before, in fact, you might have mentioned it before, your opinions on who sang it. I want your opinion on what he states, because I think it's important. Important. Let me pull it up here.
Mm-hmm.
Give me one second.
It's wrong. Crime is crime. Let's deal with it as crime. When it is a white person in South Africa, undocumented, he's called an investor. Not only a white person, including Indians and Chinese. These Guptas didn't have proper papers here. These Guptas didn't have proper papers. No one dared called them Kwerekweres. No one. But if it was my African brothers, we're going to be called Kwerekweres because they don't have papers. Self-hate. It must come to an end. If it means making the EFF lose votes for that, let it lose votes. Lose votes on principle. Not on political expediency of wanting to appeal. This country belongs to Africans in the same way Nigeria belongs to South Africans. Nigeria is South Africa. South Africa is Nigeria. We are Zimbabweans. We need to do away with this nonsensical idea that was imposed on us by colonizers, by Theresa May ancestors, that we must dislike each other. We must do away with that. Theresa May is coming here to make sure that we continue to hate each other. Look at what we are doing now. We are reclaiming our land in South Africa, saying our people must get the land, inspired by our brothers in Zimbabwe. Namibia is following. Let the whole of African continent follow and reclaim our land. That's how we're going to gain our independence. And through the ownership of the continental land, we shall then have a true one South Africa. We are unable to unite because we are divided along colonial lines, Francophones and Anglophones. We need to do away with that. We need to love our African brothers in America when they are being slaughtered, in London when they are being slaughtered. They need to know that we love them here in South Africa. They remain our brothers. Love each other everywhere else where you find one another. Protect each other, Africans, because we are in the receiving end.
Yeah, Brother Obi, that was a malema of the EFF.
Yeah, of course.
What he's saying about these attacks being orchestrated by colonialists, and when he uses that term, my mind goes to the CIA and also to the Mossad, which is Israeli's form of CIA.
Right.
Talk about what he states in reference to a lot of those attacks going on and what's really behind it.
I think that all it is it's an attempt to divert attention away from the land reclamation effort. And like I said, this is why when Comrade R.G. Mugabe and ZANU-PF embarked on their historic land reclamation program, imperialist forces consistently said the same thing, which was that even though Zimbabwe is a small country, it presents a rather peculiar threat to Western interests. So, but what it also, because if that is the focus, then that means that Africans in Azania will do what they've always done. Look to Africans all over the world to rally behind them in solidarity and camaraderie.
Okay.
And the Africans that are on the ground there will march to that drum. So if the Africans in Azania, who are there to promote a neo-colonialist agenda, if that's what's going on, then maybe that could be the reason that their presence is being met with hostility. I think that we should get to the root of that. And also, we have to, like I said, people have developed a subculture of exploiting the political mileage of issues.
And these are people who are trying to build their reputations at the expense of our movement and not build our movement. So what I would say is at this juncture, 19 years after Zimbabwe's land reclamation program, if others are going to duplicate it, the question is how is the land distributed to the people? Because land is a question of wealth and empowerment at the end of the day in the final analysis. And when Dr. King, you used his voice earlier, Dr. King, when the CIA and FBI put a bullet through his skull at 7:01 Central Time and at the Lorraine Motel, he was calling for a redistribution of wealth. Now, when we see Floyd Mayweather, when we see LeBron James, when we see Deontay Wilder, when we see Jay-Z, they're talking about generational wealth. They're talking about the accumulation of wealth, not the distribution of wealth. Because once you accumulate wealth, your number one objective becomes the preservation of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have right now in the African world, in the African context, is rich people aspiring to be wealthy, speaking for poor people. So rich people in Azania cannot be at the forefront of that land reclamation program because they will not be for equally distributing the wealth. And millionaires in Azania, billionaires in Azania will not see that process through. And what people are talking about now doesn't sound like what Sobukwe was fighting for, doesn't sound like what Biko was fighting for. That's what we're still fighting for. So that's what I'm saying. So the question of exploiting the genuine sentiments of our people, that's one thing. But at the end of the day, we want that land distributed fairly, equally amongst the masses of our people. That's our number one goal. The wealth, because as Fanon told us, wealth is not the fruit of labor, but the result of organized, protected robbery. And when you look at Southern Africa, which is the only thing standing in the way of Africa at on a governmental level being one giant neo-colony. Did we fight in Angola for Dos Santos' daughter to become the first billionaire, woman billionaire in Africa? Should Nigerians be trying to be like Ali Dangote, the richest man in Africa? Or should they be fighting to be, or should they be like Nnamdi Azikiwe, the father of the anti-colonial struggle in Nigeria? As we're having this conversation, they are 15 African billionaires on the entire planet. Are we fighting to be the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, or are we looking to share Africa's wealth with the 1.5 billion of us on this planet at the moment? So the land issue is going to intensify the class struggle in Africa. So what may look on the surface like an identity issue, which is the reason that they had the United Nations Conference on Racism, Xenophobia, and other related intolerances. We understand that. But if Africans in Azania are responding to Africans who are there from other nations in Africa pushing neocolonialism, it may not necessarily be as bad as it looks. Because I'm going to tell you something. Look at the Africans coming out of the United States to Ghana. Whose interaction with the Ghanaians is in these handful of prepositions? Clean my toilet, cook my food, drive me to the market, water my plants, sweep my house. When those Africans in Ghana erupt, wanting Nkrumahism to become a reality, are those Africans who came here out of the United States, are they going to be in the street fighting with them, or are they going to be running towards the U.S. Embassy faster than Usain Bolt? So these are the type of things that need to be dealt with and confronted. And this is why we need to have an assembling in the United States by March, wherever we have it. It doesn't have to be in one particular place. If Temple is the spot in Philadelphia, all our organizations need to come forward and talk about their Africa policy and their activity in relationship to Africa since Africa has been free of settler colonialism, because we have people who are working for the demise of Africa who are under the impression that they're working for the redemption of Africa. And it's interesting, like, look at the sanctions on Zimbabwe. Many people who have chose to criticize Comrade R.G. Mugabe, but when we would get on them and show that they didn't know what the hell they were talking about, they would always say, oh, I'm against the sanctions. But what did you do to get the sanctions lifted? What did you do to stop diplomatic terrorism? And so this is the type of conversation that we need to be having. Right now, we're in a position to match the money that the United States Agency for International Development gives to the African continent. We can match that right now. So all these people who practice what we call briefcase politics, we're ready to sit down with them and say, are you ready to finance that? So we can get the United States Agency for International Development the hell out of Africa. That should be an imperative. This is an organization that was started in 1961 by Kennedy, the same year he started the Peace Corps. Why do educators go through the State Department to have cultural exchanges in Africa? These are the type of things that we need to be dealing with as we go from COINTELPRO to OINTELPRO, overt intelligence. So if Malema's conversation is related to this concrete action, and we can guarantee from him that he will share the wealth of Azania, share the personal wealth he's already amassed with the everyday Azanian still in the township, still in huts, then we'll say he's serious. Then we'll say he's approaching Sobukwe's legacy. He's approaching Biko's legacy. Anything other than that is masquerading at the podium. And what news flash, our liberation ain't coming from no goddamn podium.
Richard.
Excuse my language.
Richard.
Brother Omar, you really shut me down because you said everything that, but you really just raised the point. For me, it's like self-reflection. And I'm if you don't mind me just going over this point, because when you say resistance, there's these
real,
two
real
types.
Real quickly, man, my name is Obi.
Obi, excuse me.
You keep calling me Ober.
the two things that get me is the resistance by observation and resistance by participation. And you just made reference to that
earlier.
Yes. Because the CBC and Comrade Mugabe's legacy, you're saying primarily those of us in North America, our politics is putting those type of representatives in place.
Hey, I didn't even look at Trans-Africa. Look, we, by defending Comrade R.D. Mugabe and ZANU-PF, we had to lock horns with Trans-Africa, which means Belafonte, which means Danny Glover. And people were like, are you out of your mind? We had to expose that the Trans-Africa Forum, who was credited with starting the anti-apartheid movement in this country, which isn't true, but that was the perception. They were funneling National Endowment for Democracy money to 14 civil society groups in Zimbabwe. The National Endowment for Democracy was created by Reagan in 83 after he gave a speech to the European Union's parliament saying that think tanks needed to be created to ensure they won the Cold War.
Wow.
After that speech, the National Endowment for Democracy was born. The National Democratic Institute was born, and the International Republican Institute was born. Madeleine Albright runs the National Democratic Institute. Carl Gershman, and for those of you who know your civil rights history, Carl Gershman was the one who people say flipped Bayard Rustin, King's advisor Bayard Rustin. The Bayard Rustin who went from marching with King and advising King to supporting Zionist Israel, telling Golda Meir, we're doing everything we can to help you stop the rise of Arab radicalism. The same Bayard Rustin that said we need to do everything we can to stop the rise of Cuban influence in Southern Africa and supported the CIA-trained mercenary unit UNITA. This is why we say the three stooges of political thought are social democracy, social justice, and social critics. I tell people all the time, if I lose my sanity, if I lose all my sanity, let me become a social justice serial killer. That way I'm still making a contribution to my people's struggle. Social justice represents a paradigm. Social Democrats represent a paradigm of people who flirted with being socialists in the 1960s and 70s. And people who are for social justice are people who still see this, still feel that justice is, you know, justice is an appetizer. Power is the entree. And Comrade R.G. Mugabe in Zimbabwe let us know we should be striving for power. You find me any national leader, any national spokesperson, whatever label they have, you put them next to us, and we will say in their face that power is the entree. Justice is nothing but an appetizer. It could be a step in the right direction. But justice is for those who believe that capitalism and imperialism must be reformed. It cannot be reformed. It must be destroyed. So I'm just saying that these are the things. So when we had to go up against Trans-Africa right now, there's a cat named Ajamu Baraka who's considering a run for the presidency, I think through the Green Party. He is connected to the Institute for Policy Studies, which is financed by George Soros. But they have a fund organization called the Black Alliance for Peace. And they have a document out on AFRICOM, which is good because the United States Africa Military Command looking to increase the presence of the U.S. military in the African continent. That must be stopped at all costs. But in their document, they say there's a part of it that says that Zimbabwe is buying weapons from AFRICOM. And we're letting Ajamu Baraka, we're putting him on notice. You need to provide the documentation that verifies that claim, because that's very dangerous. And if your researchers, whoever did that research on your behalf, made a mistake, made an error, then we need a written and public apology, because the Zimbabwean government emphatically denied your claim. Emphatically denied your claim. So these are the things that we're just forced to deal with.
But wouldn't you agree, though, since the CBC or the congressional representatives are done supposedly by a electoral vote, that if we on the ground were actually participating, looking at the global African liberation struggle, that we would be putting in place?
I agree with that. But I think what it is when we approach developments in Africa, we need to approach them as Africans, not Democrats or Republicans, but as Africans. And I think that it's just a microcosm of everything else. We see they're not going to go. They don't want to lock horns with Hillary Clinton. They didn't want to lock horns with Obama. This is why Obama, with impunity, still walks around, never having to answer for the slaughter of thousands. And interestingly enough, comrade R.G. Mugabe ignored his attacks. Because in 2006, Senator Obama wrote a letter to President Bush begging him not to lift the sanctions on Zimbabwe until the dark cloud of Mugabe, as he called it, was ousted from power. And every year during his presidency, the 8 years, he extended those sanctions. And I could tell you a personal story real quickly. I don't know if I ever have. When the inclusive government was initiated between ZANU-PF and MDC, they came to ZANU-PF, sent the former Minister of Tourism and Hospitality, Walter Mzembe, to Washington on behalf of, because President Mugabe could not come, Comrade R.G. Mugabe. And they met with Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. When you meet with the Secretary of State, you're clear to meet with the President. But earlier that day, Susan Rice did not do her UN briefing from New York. She did it in D.C. So we found that mysterious. But she had told President Obama not to let Minister Mzembe representing ZANU-PF into the White House. So when we went into the White House looking for him, he was the only one not there. And President Obama did not allow the press to ask him and Prime Minister Tsvangirai any questions. And we were told by the State Department Media Protocol Officer that was the first time during his administration that had ever been done. And when I walked in the room, he stared right in my face. He was staring at me, and everyone started looking at me. I thought it was because I was the only one that didn't have a shirt and tie on. I had on an African shirt.
Well, maybe it was that.
Maybe it was that. So then he nods his head at me. I don't budge. Then he says, if any of you are wondering why we're not going to engage the press. And he looks at me again and says, my record, my position in Zimbabwe is a matter of public record. And I'm saying to myself, those are Michelle Gavin's words. Those are Johnny Carson's words. Those are Susan Rice's words. You're not that thorough on African history, because I don't think African history was a priority in Indonesia and Hawaii anyway. But besides that.
Now, he was saying that in reference to you being there.
Yeah, and then I broke the story that he banned Minister Nzimbi from the White House, and it was on the front page of the Herald the next day. So that was, and then I made a mistake, an intellectual mistake. I later went on Your World News, and I challenged President Obama to a debate on Zimbabwe, and I regret that. The reason I regret it is because it shouldn't have been called a debate, because that has antagonistic overtones. It should have been called a discussion, because if I'm debating Barack Obama on Zimbabwe, everyone would accuse me of being a bully, because I would demolish him. Because there's nothing that Susan Rice could give him, nothing that Johnny Carson could give him, nothing that Michelle Gavin could give him that would prepare him. He ain't equipped intellectually. He's not equipped politically. I'd send him back to George Soros and Michelle crying. But besides that point, this is just an example of what we had to go against. So that's why I say that Zimbabwe is calculus. So when you got to look at Randall, and I remember seeing Randall Robinson in Selma and asking him, how in the hell could you allow Trans Africa to be working for the National Endowment for Democracy to bring about regime change in Zimbabwe? You were in Rufalo Stadium the night the Zimbabwean flag went up, the night that Bob Marley paid out of his own pocket for his music equipment to come to Zimbabwe because he felt historically obligated to be there. How could you? Forget the fact that you posed as the creator of the anti-apartheid movement, even though you started in 1977 and SNCC organizers were going to jail for protests in front of the South African consulates in New York and D.C. in 64. Du Bois and Robeson had the Council of African Affairs and were working with ANC in the 30s and 40s. Forget that part. But how could you just flip like that and work for the overthrow of Comrade R.G. Mugabe? What could he possibly have done for you to just have a complete shift to the extreme right of that sort? So this is what we've been up against.
Did he give you an answer or just blew it off?
Hell no. Okay. No. He was shocked. And this is why whenever we go in front of the leaders, and because part of my responsibility, I give the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the National Conference of Black State Legislators, the National Medical Association, the Nation of Islam, we have the Universal African American People's Organization, the New African People's Organization. I meet with them and give them briefings and updates on the developments in Zimbabwe, hoping that they will come out against the sanctions. We've sent people to do their medical residency in Kadoma. We've set people up to do cryptocurrency projects in Zimbabwe to ease the burden of the sanctions. It isn't just about these interviews, as you all know. We've written three children's plays on Zimbabwe, one about Amai Sally Mugabe, one about Josiah Tongazar, who led the guerrilla struggle, one about the Heroes Acre, where President Mugabe will be buried next month. We created an appeal that organizations throughout the diaspora signed against the sanctions, which was the most inclusive document of Africans in the diaspora opposing that genocidal policy. We created three albums with M1 from Dead Prez, dealing with getting the sanctions on Zimbabwe lifted and the blockade on Cuba lifted, which you all have played on the show. So we did an appeal dealing with Zimbabwe being blocked from Global Fund to deal with the HIV/AIDS development. So we've done all that in 17 years, and we were not seeking to be consultants, paid consultants. And at the time we were doing this work for Zimbabwe, Reverend Walter Fauntroy was seeking a contract from Zimbabwe. Former Congressman Ron Dellums was seeking a contract from Zimbabwe. The Hebrew Israelites were seeking a contract from Zimbabwe. And everything that I told you that we did for them, we did for nothing. For nothing.
You know, Richard, Brother Obi was on the national show, the Carl Nelson show on Friday. And he broadcasted from the CBC.
Mm-hmm.
In case you don't know, Richard, or a listening audience.
Yeah.
And Obie was the first guest. And when he said, "I'm down here in the among enemies," I mean, he let them have it in a national forum, you know. And I guess people might have been wondering, I mean, why would you do that? You know, but listen, if anybody knows this man's work and he lets you know just in a little snippet tonight about his relationship with some of these people that sit in that CBC, what they have said behind closed doors, the things they have done behind closed doors, and then come in the public and show a different face or show like they're working for the community. Now you see why he would go on a Carl Nelson show and basically blast them. Now,
and you know what I was thinking about the whole time, and I did mention it in the show. When the Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company did a play, Same Neighborhood, Different Perspectives, a conversation between General Colin Powell and Kwame Ture. What ended up happening is we read Colin Powell's autobiography, An American Journey. And you know what he talks about? He talks about how he flew to Mandela's inauguration. And he said he was on the plane with the Black Caucus and they were playing cards. And he said that Ron Dellums told him that if he would have come out and switched parties, they would have supported him for the presidency. So this was 1994. And I'm sitting there thinking, damn, Colin Powell was the Secretary of State when the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act was pushed. The Black Caucus all voted, so it showed me that the regime change agenda, as it pertains to Zimbabwe, is bipartisan for people who enjoy the lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans. It just lets them know that that's what it's really about. So, man, I mean, we're just working. We're just trying to work. We're just trying to organize, and we're going to keep doing what we're doing. And Eritrea has shown us, you know, they got the sanctions lifted on them at the end of last year. So it can be done, I mean, but it requires discipline, it requires consistency. And I just wish that people who, everybody that's weighed in on what they feel Comrade R.G. Mugabe represents intellectually, politically, historically, I just hope all of them are fighting and organizing to lift the sanctions and want to use this as an opportunity to build stronger bridges with the people of Southern Africa. Because people who claim to be Pan-Africanist at certain points in times when it's convenient, I guess, they treat West Africa like it's the entire African continent, and they won't touch anything outside of Western Africa, knowing that if they're paying attention to Africa like we hope they are, neocolonialism is the engine is in West Africa right now, as we explained. So we feel that this is why we need to have public engagement this election year, just about Africa policy. And I don't think we've ever done that, where on a national level, we all assembled and just talked about the work we've done on the ground in Africa, so we can take a look at what work is detrimental, what work is beneficial. And, you know, when we did when we ended up doing the benefit for the cyclone victims in Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Mozambique back in April, we saw how pleased that diplomatic corps was. The Appeal Incorporated helped us put that together. And they were asking us the question. They were saying, you know, they were like, yo, why are they smiling? I said, because they're used to people coming to them to do this type of work, charging them $1 or $2 million just to do it. So they're being reintroduced to our community here, and they see why we hold them so special. So when you look at Comrade Mugabe's legacy, like I said, Mozambique was secured because of ZANU-PF. The Congo was secured because of ZANU-PF. And on a diplomatic front, Zimbabwe was chairing the non-aligned movement when Namibia got its independence. So these were very important developments in the process that they never got their credit for. But in the spirit of true service, you know, you don't run around seeking accolades for what you do. You just do what you feel history obligates you to do. So that's what they represent. That's what defines them. And we're just proud and humbled to have been, to have played a small role in this fight. And we're just going to keep on working, because we know that that's what he would want and that's what he would expect. Because all fighters of that magnitude, they don't suffer from vanity, but they do wonder what the struggle is going to look like when they're no longer physically a part of it.
Brother Obi, before we let you go this evening and wind things down, I want you to take off your journalist hat, put on your playwright mm-hmm. hat, and tell me where the children yeah. are performing in the coming months okay. and some of the things on tap.
We started something new, man, called the Mass Emphasis Positive Action and Creativity Youth Brigade. This summer, we had two special projects, which you know about. One of them was we created a project called, it was a mixtape, a visual mixtape, in tribute to Kwame Ture, done by a 10-year-old and 13-year-old, Xavier and Jabari Reed. And we sent that to you, and I think you posted it.
Yeah.
So it's a visual mixtape, and it was done on Kwame Ture's birthday weekend. And then we had a 19-year-old hip-hop artist, Zion Yutzi, we co-produced a video with him called Vision. And it was in loving recognition of Cuba and Venezuela's work that led to the restoration of eyesight for thousands of Africans on the verge of blindness in Cuba and Venezuela. So, we are off to a very, and so we're looking for young people who have artistic talent, who can sing, who can dance, who can write, who can draw, who can paint, who can rap, and who can direct and produce material. And we're looking to create projects rooted in our resistance to heighten our struggle, to intensify our struggle. And this summer, for African Liberation Day, our last play was 1925. It was about the childhood of Malcolm, Lumumba, and Fanon, who were all born in 1925. We're going to perform that play again in December.
Okay.
And next year, for African Liberation Day, we're writing four separate plays. I won't let the cat out of the bag, but we will be writing a play that will be performed by young people in Haiti. We will be writing a play performed by young people in Guyana. And we will be writing a play that will be performed potentially by young people in Ghana. And they will be all different plays. And the one we'll be doing in this country is Ready for the Revolution. And it will be a tribute to Ahmed Sekou Touré and Mbalia Kamara, the founders of the Democratic Party of Guinea. For those of you who knew Kwame Touré and had a chance to interact with him, he always answered the phone, Ready for the Revolution. And people thought that that was him. But the slogan actually comes from the revolutionary fighting forces on the ground in Conakry, Guinea. So that's what we've been up to. That's what we've been doing. And so we're looking, you know, there are young people who are interested. The brigade, once again, the ages on that are up to 21. For Mass Emphasis Children's History and Theater Company, it's from 5 to 18. But for the brigade, the ages would be like from 7 to 21. So if you're artistically gifted and talented, and want to create projects rooted in resistance for the purpose of heightening our resistance, this is the process for you, because the reality is all children don't want to get performant before us and act. Sometimes they're nervous. But if they are photographers, if they're videographers, if they're already documentarians, if they're singers, if they're dancers, they would have no problem creating a project in connection with their skills, especially at a time where, as Comrade R.G. Mugabe used to tell us, the number one problem for the African was the brain drain. Our best doctors don't work in Africa. Our best teachers don't work in Africa. Our best engineers don't work in Africa or for the African world, either on the continent or the diaspora. They serve our enemies. Our enemies benefit more from their labor than the masses of their people, who they owe their skills and talents to benefit from their labor. And we're looking to change that.
Brother Obi, listen, thank you for being with us, man. I'm glad that you were able to come on this evening and share with us. I know that
I'm so, man. I love you all so much. I really respect your work, and I'm glad I had a chance to finally meet you. And I could just feel your energy, man. And when I deal with you, I know I'm dealing with a genuine comrade in every sense of the word. So any chance I have an opportunity to partner with you, to have a healthy exchange with you, it's my honor. It's my privilege.
Listen, I want to say this before we go, because I see you, I see your work, being a journalist, a playwright, I don't know how you have the energy, man, but I'm just happy to be able to call you a friend. And just, you know, it makes me proud to know that I know somebody like you that is a wealth of information and that is active on top of having information. I know that the spirit of your father is looking down.
That's very proud of you. That's the key, you know, that's the key right there. Like what you just said right there just makes it, that was more important than anything that I shared in the last 2 hours. You know what I mean? The fact that you said, we're active around these things. And that disparity between the articulators and the executors is too wide for for me. I can't stand it. But at the same time, I know that we represent the alternative to the superficiality. Us and so many other fearless and selfless fighters and servants out here. So we just going to keep working, man. Can't complain about it. Complaining takes away from the contributions that we can make to reverse that trend so it can be in our favor. So, man, you know, we embrace the challenge to overcome every obstacle that stands in our way, just like Comrade R.G. Mugabe did. Long live Comrade R.G. Mugabe. Long live Zimbabwe. Long live Africa. Long live the fighters of the past and the fighters of the present and the fighters of the future.
Brother, we'll talk soon.
Yeah. Peace.
All right.
Peace.
Right.
Richard.
Yes.
It's good. It's always good to have Brother Obi on because he gives a perspective, man, of somebody that's doing the work at a higher level, but is grassroots all the way. It's difficult to find people like him. And it might be difficult for me to put it in words, the type of spirit that he has. But for the listeners that heard him tonight, I guess you can kind of surmise the type of person that he is. He's a unique brother, and I'm glad to know him.
And I'm hoping that those who listen to the podcast really take the time, you know, to break out the history lesson, the political economic lesson, the power lesson, and the different institutions that are involved in colonialism. And also, and this, you know, and I was trying to just make one point, you know, Elliot, for those of us who participate in the electoral process, we see that those representatives, whether you are an African nationalist, a socialist or not, they are instrumental in using the Zimbabwe. And what he said is, which is so powerful for Southern Africa and Africa in general, the land reclamation project, right? If they are not the representatives that are supporting African policies that support the sanction, you know, the lifting of the sanctions, or we are not able to answer, or how, or at least from our vantage point, the land should be distributed and how these here U.S. institutions shouldn't be involved, State Department, government department, political representatives, then we are complicit. And if we don't accept that, we can argue what is socialism, capitalism, or whatever, but you can't be, and that's why I love what he said, the difference between being observational, you know, resistance from observation and resistance from participation. He's dealing with resistance from participation. And that's what I hear you're saying of someone who is actually on the ground, who is being able to, you know, articulate to us all the intricacies of those institutions and individuals that are involved in the colonization and not allowing the decolonization of Africa, but also creating the new neo-nationalism through this here, whether it be about tourism or, again, by maintaining the sanctions on Zimbabwe. You know, it's no, for us who constantly look at, you know, we constantly push for independent political representation, whether that be by parties or people taking control, sovereign control of areas on their own, we push for that. But if we can put the same kind of people in place, if we're going to use that process, then we're complicit in that. And yes, that's, and I think it's important for us to accept that.
And, you know? And the thing is, the key to that also, Riches, is that the people have to have the proper information. Because, listen, before some folks heard this program tonight, they might not be aware that some of their representatives that's still sitting in office now, was names was mentioned here tonight in private meetings with him, with the former president that passed away, well, not former president, the president that passed, Mugabe, in reference to some of the things they said and promised, his interaction with the, Obama, which he probably told me before, but it kind of slipped my mind. All of these things, they all play in what is going on. We need the proper information. That way now, when some of our listening audience be able to confront some of these leaders, because, listen, you might not see them all year, but believe me, when it comes election time, you'll see them in your community. There'll be a community centers and things like that asking for your votes. Then you'll have a dossier. You'll have a scorecard where you can ask them questions. And then you might see them stammer or just look at you crazy, like he said that Ron Dellums did when he confronted him in Selma.
Mm-hmm. And it goes on to the point, and this is important to reemphasize, when he makes the question for commentators, you know, those who look at the Palestinian issue and not equate that what's going on in Palestine and what people are advocating for the liberation of Palestine in this manner, or how we're dealing with the sanctions within Palestine, that same understanding or equation should be raised in relationship to Zimbabwe. And most importantly to me, which, you know, I think I'm glad that they're, you know, again, someone we know here at Time for Awakening, Brother Omawali, that they're talking about bringing people together who are actually dealing with African policy and having them talk about the work, not just the talk, but talk about the work they're doing on the ground as it relates to policy, so that when we do confront these individuals, we can point to places where they should be supporting, obviously that they're not.
And Richard, listen, a lot of these conversations are going to have to come from the grassroots level, and I agree. But I'm not going to take the onus off of the so-called leadership, this black bourgeoisie, because these conversations about U.S. policy on the continent should be had by them. They should be spearheading this conversation. You would never have European representatives here questioning U.S. policy towards any country in Europe, because they're in solidarity with those countries. They might have their little squabbles here and there, but as far as policy, they're going to help them out. They're going to be in favor of it. Even if others try to pull out, like what is it, Britain trying to pull out and become part of
BRICS.
They still, you had this president now go over there and say that we're still in your corner. They're going to help one another. But you got African leadership here, or African-American leadership, that don't want to bring up this country's policy on the continent, or secretly go along with their policy, but don't let the people know. This is something that got to be confronted. We got to call. What does Cynthia McKinney say in the clip that I always play? Said it on our program. We got to call these people out in our community and do something about it. That's what she said, and I agree. We can't just call it. We got to do something about it, or it's going to continue. Go ahead, Richard.
No. I was just reemphasizing the point that, and that's why we need to be, you know, informed on what those policies are.
Exactly.
Because we see those, we do see that tourism is being pushed. But, you know, the clarity of who and how long out of, you know, these institutions, U.S. African Businesses Associations have been in development of these policies that are pushing tourism, and you see everybody running, you know, to it. So it's it may be a different type of, it may be what we don't want, especially those of us who really want to see. And that's what I think is his main point, you know, and all of our main point. It's not about adjustment. It's about power. But it's also about, and I think it's clear when we're talking about, and he's making a clear observation. When we're talking about land distribution, you know, we have to talk about how it's going to be done. Not just saying that land need to be, you know, we need to get the land back. And then you have feudalism or people who are going to control, or certain ethnic groups that will be control over large tracts of land. How is this land going to be distributed amongst the people who have, because of colonialism, who have lost the land and really lost wealth? Because of, you know, the displacement. And that's there and here.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We kind of went a little over. I guess we'll get a chance maybe Friday's program to kind of recap some things from today. It was interesting to be with Dr. Rashidi over there at the museum, and some of the, like I told you before, I hadn't been in that museum, Richard, in over 20 years. And especially that exhibit up there where, you know, a lot of our ancestors' stuff is housed. And that's just one museum here in Philadelphia. I'm not even talking about all over.
And he named the 10 and the top five.
Yeah, it was very interesting today. And we'll kind of maybe get into that a little on Friday. Before we leave, I want to kind of recap the lineup on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Time for an Awakening Media. Always interesting conversation on African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. From 1 to 3, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed on Time for an Awakening Media. And every first and third Monday, Conversation Reparations, the Encobra program. And I don't know, you know, I got to check my schedule, but the tuners can tune in at 9 tomorrow. I'm more than sure that this might be the week, but every first and third Monday on Time for an Awakening Media, Conversation Reparations, the Encobra program is from 9 to 10. And then from 10 to 12, Night Talk with Warren Ballantyne, the Warren Ballantyne program. Warren was on vacation about 3 days last week, so he didn't do his show, but he'll be back on schedule most likely on Monday. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive is back with Sister POC, and I think she is back because she was down for the count a little bit, Richard. She had tore her Achilles. So she was convalescing for a little while, but I think she's back on schedule. From 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening on Wednesday. On Thursday, Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. And then on Fridays, Time for an Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
Driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. Have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. play such a small part of the things that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman.
To save the children.